Welcome to the 9-8s podcast, hosted by yours truly, Kevin Thompson, founder and CEO of 9-8 Capital Group. Thank you guys for joining me. As I always say, subscribe to the channel. As I always say, go and get my book, MLB the CFP, live on Apple and Amazon. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at info@99capitalgroup.com. Send us your questions, go to the website at www.99capitalgroup.com. Schedule your appointment. Also, follow us on all of the social media platforms at MLB the CFP. Thank you guys for joining us. Today, we have an interesting individual. But before I go there, as you know, we're here to do what? Educate, empower, and engage, and also entertain. But like I say, wonderful individual, Meredith McGraw, author of Trump in Exile. We're going to be talking about the man, the myth, the legend. You can knock him down, but you can't keep him away. Don't say his name three times like Beetlejuice. But again, we're here to talk about Trump in Exile with Meredith McGraw. Meredith, welcome to the show. Let's get it. Meredith, thank you for joining the 9-8s podcast. This is going to be an exciting expose of something that happened a few years prior to where we are today. But before we go there, you were with Politico. Now you're going to where?
I'm heading to the Wall Street Journal to join their White House team. Thank you.
Congratulations. So if you guys don't know, Meredith McGraw, she's written a book, Trump in Exile. We're going to be talking about that today. Honestly, it's a really funny story, in my opinion. We'll just get there. But at the end of the day, what you've done, White House reporting, these last 4 years, let's just say last 8 years, it's had to be a boon for a person like yourself.
I mean, it's been a wild ride. I covered Trump in the White House.
Yeah.
And then after he lost, I really thought I was going to be covering the Biden White House. And my editors, I think to their credit, recognized that Trump was still going to be a big story. What he would do would have ramifications, of course, for the GOP. And I don't think anybody, myself included, could have seen him being reelected, though, and coming back to the White House. So it's been a story that I don't think any of us could have predicted at all.
Well, your book is about that, the transition from 2000 to 2024, 2020 to 2024, his time at Mar-a-Lago. I mean, and Trump in Exile, the book that you've written, it was a page turner, because you couldn't pull yourself from it, because you're thinking, what kind of man are we dealing with? After January 6th, and let's just get right into it. You had a beaten man getting on his plane to go back to Mar-a-Lago and kind of sulk. And the next thing you know, it was a beaten man, right? Like the day one, he was just like, I don't know where to go from here. Fox News, all these other news stations were just killing him nationally. Like, oh, we're done with him. He should never come back. And then this guy's like a cockroach or something, man. He's like, you can't kill him. No pun intended, but you can't just push him away, because at the end of the day, he keeps coming back. So let's talk about those first days in Mar-a-Lago and all the things that he had to be dealing with, because you wrote about it eloquently in your book.
So, yeah, I really try to set it up in the first few pages of like just what a dark moment this was for Donald Trump and what a low moment this was for him politically. We all remember what January 6th was like. That is like ingrained in all of our memories. And I think for Trump, there was these like few weeks until January 20th, when he had to leave the White House, where both he and his staff were floundering. Trump was still fixated on ideas that he could still stay in the White House. But then he packed his bags and made a goodbye speech and went on his way to Palm Beach and to Mar-a-Lago. And, you know, even that goodbye ceremony where he gave his speech, it was hard for staff to get enough people to go. Yeah. And he said during that, you know, this isn't, you know, goodbye, I'll be back in some form. But so I think, you know, the wheels were already turning for him, that, you know, he could try to make some move politically, but this was a real low point. The Senate wanted him gone, the House wanted him gone, every Republican in Washington, like you said, some of his, you know, biggest conservative cheerleaders, the Fox News talking heads, were all pretty disgusted at that point by January 6th and by the way things had ended. And so it was sort of like good riddance and goodbye. And even when he got back to Palm Beach, he was really floundering. He did start to get involved in some political activities. You know, he had some endorsements that he rattled off pretty much immediately and started to dip his toes back again into stuff. But it was a real low point for him. And he wasn't quite sure how this was all going to play out.
Well, you mentioned the low point, and in the book you wrote about this, and I can see this picture. He's landing in Florida, and he's not seeing anybody at the tarmac. It's like, oh my God, this is really over. And he starts driving down the street, and then these trucks just start following him with these banners, Trump, Trump, Trump. And that was like a reinvigoration for him, and more like an understanding, like, hey, these people are with me. So, like, what role do you think that played in him giving this another go and seeing that people really rallied around him, even though it could have been 100 or 200 or whatnot? But people were truly what we call MAGA.
Yeah, I mean, I think the moment was, the way it was described to me was, it was psychologically important in a lot of ways. You know, he lands and he's surrounded in Palm Beach, the bright blue skies, it's sunny, it's not gray, and, you know, like it is in D.C. this time of year. And, you know, like you said, he has all of these fans that are with him. And I do think that that's something that was lost on a lot of people at that moment was, sure, Trump was this political outcast, but he had really built this huge political movement. And, you know, the Republican Party, they say like 30% or so is like this hardcore, at least then it was like this hardcore MAGA base. Mm-hmm. And that's not a number that you can like throw out, that like, you know, a good chunk of the GOP was like thoroughly with him no matter what. And they showed up for him.
So let's get into that, because we're kind of going, you know, from point to point. That's my confusion about a lot of this, because if you don't show loyalty to Donald J. Trump, you're in danger of losing your seat, quote unquote, like Liz Cheney and a lot of and the 10 members that were in the group that wanted him to be outcast, basically, from any type of political seat moving forward. So if you're not loyal to him, he will basically come after you with everything he's got. I mean, he will raise political action committees against you, like Liz Cheney, like they did to Liz Cheney. And is it Wyoming, right? She's in Wyoming?
Yeah, Wyoming.
Yeah. They'll do all these things. So how easy is it for people just to say, you know what? Let's bend the knee in a Game of Thrones term, right? Let's bend the knee. Let's just act like we want to appease him just so we can keep our seats?
Well, you know, the way we all describe loyalty in Donald Trump, sometimes it sounds like you're talking about some mob boss, because it really is kind of the way he views the world. It is this sort of like Godfather-esque view of like, you know, if you cross me, well, you better watch out. And when he got back to Palm Beach and to Mar-a-Lago, the impeachment trials were, you know, the second impeachment trials were happening. And he was pretty fixated on making sure that those 10 House members that voted to impeach him, that their political career would essentially be over. And that was a big focus for him and his team. You know, going towards, you know, moving towards the midterms, and the primaries. But, you know, for him, like loyalty is everything. And even now what we're seeing with the transition and how that's playing out, you know, if somebody has been critical of Donald Trump, like say, you know, Nikki Haley, when she ran against Trump in the Republican primary, he was like ruled anybody out that like worked for her or, you know, Nikki Haley herself from joining the administration because he thinks that they were disloyal in some way.
Disloyal. And I also believe that he puts people in power that won't outshine him. And quote unquote, I believe that Nikki Haley is one that would have outshined him in his current form. So I think he wants to minimize that impact. Another thing, I don't get this. And I know they call it mudslinging in politics.
Yeah.
But help me understand, and this is not really talking about this book, but help me understand how someone can talk about your family in your face and then just say, oh, this is just politics. Like, I told my wife this. I said, babe, listen, if someone called you ugly on a national stage, he's getting these hands really quickly. I'm sorry. Not to go that way, but we can't be friends anymore. I mean, I don't understand this. And this is what you see in this current political environment.
Yeah, I mean,
As a man.
I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. But I think, you know, so soon after when Trump got down to Palm Beach, one of the most important meetings that he had that I describe in that book is the one that he had with Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah.
And when Kevin McCarthy was going to be down in Palm Beach for a fundraiser and Trump's team had reached out, you know, why don't you have stop by? And so McCarthy came by for lunch and it turned into this like huge moment because Trump's team sent out a press release and a photo of them together. And it like really signaled to Republicans, whether McCarthy actually liked that message or not, that Trump was back and people like McCarthy who, McCarthy needs to fundraise as speaker. He needs to have, you know, strong political influence that somebody like Trump is really the only one they felt could provide. So you saw a lot of people and Kevin McCarthy said all sorts of things about Trump after January 6th. And there is a long list of Republicans who have been critical of Trump. Or he has said like really nasty, horrific things about that, you know, are squarely on his team now. I mean, you were kind of referring there to like Senator Ted Cruz and what Trump said. I mean, how would you let that go? And yet, you know, Ted Cruz is now a huge ally of his. And, you know, some of it I think is like, just political survival, and some of it is, I do think the Republican Party and the way these politicians their conservative viewpoint has evolved in a big way in the past 10 years, too.
Well, couldn't be me. I'll tell you that right now. But you did mention only 2 of the 10 Republican people that opposed Trump during the impeachment trials. I believe there's only 2 of them that are still in their seats right now. The other 8 either just dropped out of the race or lost like Liz Cheney. But what do you think that lasting message to the party actually is, that if you cross him, there are consequences?
I think,
you could literally lose your seat. You could lose your livelihood. And like you said, it's like a mob boss. So,
yeah, I mean, he would scorched earth with people. At that moment, it was really about trying to regain power and control. And so it was really, it was, like you said, it was about sending a message to these people that you better like shut up and get in line and, get on my team or else. At the same time, it's been interesting to try to see how some Republicans have tried to navigate around him at times. You know, we've seen some of the limits of Trump's influence, too. He's weighed in on, you know, different pieces of legislation over the years, or, he's tried to put his hand in, you know, different elections, and it didn't always pan out. Yes. So I think there's like, there's sort of two things going on where there's like this perception that, you know, if you go against Trump or you speak out against him, your career is over. And yet at the same time, we've seen over and over again, there has been like a lot of dissent that has shown that Trump's influence only does go so far. It is important, but it hasn't been sort of the end-all be-all all the time.
Yeah. And you've been in this environment. This is your world, politics. You've been around the White House. You've done the correspondence. And one big thing has been about election interference. Like we had 2016, we had the possible Russian election interference. We've had the drop boxes on fire and all this other stuff. I won another 11,000 votes for Georgia and all this other stuff. So I guess my question is, Trump has been very vocal about election fraud. In your book, that was one of his main talking points since, like, when he got back to Mar-a-Lago. How did he get all these votes? That's impossible. That's not enough of people that can vote to get him 81 million votes. Where's this coming from? Your book details that and how money was funneled into election results and all the other thing. How does he reconcile this contradiction in regards to the hypocrisy he says about election interference, but then he goes around and interferes with elections, whether it be in Wyoming to get Liz Cheney out, getting Peter Thiel's money, or all the other things he's putting his hands in using his super PAC?
Isn't that
hypocritical in itself?
I think, well, rich people getting involved in races, politicians getting involved in races, the super PAC money has been around for a while now. And I think in his view, his team's view, it's like it's, you know, spending money for ad campaigns and ground game operations through super PACs is legal because of Citizens United. But, you know, I think for Trump, when you think about like Mark Zuckerberg and Trump was furious at Facebook because he was banned from their platform. You know, he felt the same way about Twitter. And so I think with Mark Zuckerberg in particular, you know, the Mark and Priscilla Chan Foundation had given money to, you know, to certain parts of the country to help with like getting voters out during COVID, and what they
votes were doing went way up. Yeah, votes went way
yeah,
up.
Yeah, and what they were doing, or what that money was doing, like I don't know if Priscilla and Mark Zuckerberg personally knew where their money was going, right? But
yeah,
but you know, all of that was legal too. But you know, in Donald Trump's mind, it was like a lot more personal than that.
Yeah. And then he gets Peter Thiel to do the exact same thing, but in a different environment and on a smaller scale. And I mean, it's just hypocritical in itself. So I guess my next question is going to be, do you think Trump genuinely believes the election was stolen? Or is that something that he knows his base? That's something he believes his base believes, so he's going to believe it himself? Or do you think he genuinely believes that the election was stolen, or there's always been fraud in our elections?
So this was really something I tried to get to the bottom of for this when I was interviewing people for this book. I mean, this has been also something that, you know, special counsel has tried to get to the bottom of too. You know, the January 6th committees. When I would talk to his aides, the people who were the closest to him, who spend all their time with him, and I'd be like, does he really believe this? And one of them was like, you know what? I bet if you put him to a lie detector test, he would say that he genuinely believes that this election was stolen, that he actually believes this. And you know, there's obviously a ton of evidence that suggests that otherwise. But for him, at least according to his aides, they really felt like he truly believed it to his core.
Well, I mean, of course, if you say something long enough and you can start training your mind to believe it. And right. Of course, you know what I mean? So at the end of the day, he said it so often, since 2016, he's been saying the same thing over and over again. And now, I mean, now one thing I will.
You know, now that he won, he didn't hear a ton about, you know, election fraud or anything like that. Although I think there were efforts by the Republican Party to mitigate some of that. It is always funny how Democrats have done this too when they've lost elections, you know. So It's always funny when parties win, how quiet they are about that. So
Yeah. Couple more questions. This is a great book, by the way. I appreciate you giving us some time on the 90 News podcast. Let's talk about political tribalism and the psychology around it. Your book highlights how Trump messaging taps into the deep psychological and emotional triggers that the MAGA group has. You know, the economy's not for you. This whole thing has been a game against you. Why? Because I've used this system. I know how this system works, right? So, but again, you're hiring billionaires and all that. But I'm not getting into any political debate here. But at the end of the day, what makes his approach so effective compared to traditional political rhetoric? Like, why are people falling in line? Is it because the French Revolution effect where like, hey, we're all poor, you know, because the group, the majority of the people that are heavily red are those states that are really, really poor. So is it one of those things where those individuals are so hard behind the Republicans to help them get changed because their states are just so poor? And is it because, well, the Republican controlled state, so they may just be one of those things that they're just in a poor environment because of Republican control? I'm not saying, again, I'm not Democrat or Republican. I'm just kind of trying to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, I mean, political tribalism in America has always been around. But I do think with Donald Trump and the sort of realignment he had with the Republican Party, if you look at just the results from this election, the gains that he made with, you know, demographics that have traditionally gone for Democrats, union members, Black men, Hispanic males, too.
But they say that, and I have a lot of Black friends, okay, because I'm a Black man, right?
Yeah.
I'm just like, hey, man. I was like, where did they get this evidence from? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No. It's just totally fair. But I do think one of the things that Trump was able to do with his, you know, some of his messaging is race baiting.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's demagoguery, all of that. And some of it, though, is it's sort of counterintuitive when you consider who he is. Like, he's been this like Fifth Avenue, like, you know,
he's a monopoly.
Yeah, exactly. But he's been able to go to and reach these people, I think, because of his celebrity. I don't think in America you can discount just simply the power of celebrity and impact that has, but he was able to reach these people and recognize that they were looking for a champion. And also he was talking maybe the way that they spoke to, saying the sort of things that were only shared, you know, privately. Trump was saying them out loud. And I think warts and all, revealing all of the economic insecurities that some of these people had. And I think there's a lot of like white identity politics too that played into it too, where that Trump was tapping into that as well.
Yeah, they're taking over your country. You're losing your country. Mm-hmm. Last thing here, a couple more questions if you don't mind. So the parallels between Trump's strategy and the populist leaders throughout history. Can you tell us a little bit about like from what your research has told you, like what are some of the parallels Trump and populism have in common?
Well, I think Trump has a lot of the same characteristics you've seen in populist leaders over the years. And, you know, I really keep thinking back to who the Republican Party nominated for president, it's like it paints such a clear picture of like how populism and its role just and Trump in transforming it. I mean, you go from having, you know, George W. Bush and, you know, John McCain, Mitt Romney, and
sailing those guys now.
Exactly. It's funny how like history is.
I want those guys back.
Yeah, you know, but you know, Trump and, you know, his rhetoric on trade and his rhetoric on, like, you know, America first and you know, we're not going to be involving ourselves in wars abroad. It's just going to be focused on you, and I care about you, the people. I mean, you hear these same tones and rhetoric for years with populist leaders, and so much of it is like just coming straight from that playbook.
You had a wonderful book. Thank you for for writing. It was a wonderful expose of what happened in Mar-a-Lago. Wonderful expose of a man that was beaten down that you can never count against. That's one thing I've learned about Trump. Hate him or love him, that guy is a warrior and he's going to find a way to make something happen. So what is one of the key takeaways you want your readers of Trump in Exile? What are one of the key takeaways you want them to have?
Oh, gosh. I'll be honest with you. It's sort of hard for me to like distill one thing. You know, I've always been interested in these moments where people are at a low point and how they handle that. And, you know, this book goes into how Trump used every avenue he could, whether it was creating his own social media platform, influencing elections, you know, whether it was just everything he did, how he used that to sort of propel himself forward. And, you know, I also think that the book provides some pretty good insight into who's around him. And I think that's something that's important to think about during this era, Trump with people like Susie Wiles. And you talk about loyalty. She showed up to work for him in early 2021 when not a lot of people would. And yeah, She's now his chief of staff at the White House, the incoming chief of staff. So I do think it goes into some of the people that Trump put around him and the political operation he built too.
Well, you know, the major takeaways I got was, as long as he ain't paying you, he loves you. Like I said, like, he had to pay these people. It's like, hey, yeah, I like you. Yeah. As long as there's no money coming out of his pocket, he's okay. No, I kid.
No, fair enough.
But again, it was a wonderful book, wonderful expose of what happened to a man that the world can't hold down. There's been so much going against him, whether it be the Democrats not liking him, whether it be Republicans not liking him. This guy continues to carry on. And that right there, my friend, is a testament of what America kind of stands for, right? You beat us down, but we're going to continue to find ways to succeed. Meredith, thank you for this book. Where can they find it? Tell the people a little bit about yourself. Like, what's next coming down the pipe? And then Where can they find your book?
So you can find her book or this book, hopefully, at any local bookstore, retailer, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. But, you know, always encourage people to visit their local bookstores and have them order it in for you, or check it out from your local library. I am, you know, we're just days away from the inauguration, so I'm gearing up to cover this next White House, and it's going to be a jam-packed 100 days. It's always essential for every incoming president to like hit the ground running and, you know, with executive orders, legislation, you know, big policy moves. So we're going to be waiting to see what Trump and his team have in store and what happens on Capitol Hill.
You got a jam-packed 4 years. We're praying for you.
Thank you.
The wonderful time. And I appreciate you joining the 90s podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We had Meredith McGraw on the 90s podcast, talk about Trump in exile. We're talking about the defeat after Mar-a-Lago, how this man was beaten down, how he the resurgence of Donald Trump into the next election, how he used his political power to subdue his rivals and how this man uses the political system like it's always been used, but it's just in your face. So the most important thing I want you guys to get out of this is this. He's not doing anything any differently than has been done in the past. He's just doing it out in the open for you to see. Thank you guys for joining the 90s podcast. Subscribe to the channel. Go and get my book, MLB to CFP, live on Apple and Amazon. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at info@99capitalgroup.com. Send us your question. Go to the website at www.99capitalgroup.com. Schedule an appointment. Also, go to any other social media networks and follow us at MLB to CFP. As you know, we're here to do what? Educate, empower, and engage. Thank you guys for joining the 90s podcast. Stay humble, stay safe, my friend. I'll see you again soon.